It's the post-Canada Day election, edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Maple Leaf on our flag, Schedule 1 drugs, atheist monuments, and the good, the bad, and the ugly of food reporting. Let's begin episode 217.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast promoting skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ethan.
Yes.
Were you involved in the plot yesterday?
Which plot were you referring to, Don?
I'm talking about the reports that the RCMP has arrested a couple from Surrey for attempting to blow up a pressure cooker bomb at the Victoria Canada Day celebrations. Where were you exactly again?
I was in my home, fleeing the oppressive heat of the long weekend. So hopefully the RCMP will get on that
promptly. It will be kind of interesting, you know, because this is like a local terrorism sort of story, and it's being reported in, by the RCMP as terrorism, and it's not like, ooh, these were just crazy people doing crazy things. So that could be kind of interesting, you know, never know how it might show up in the future.
Absolutely. Speaking of Canada Day, that was yesterday, and of course that is the day we celebrate the anniversary of July 1st, 1867, the enactment of the British North America Act, which created Canada. Well, sort of. Anyway, Canadians like to celebrate by barbecuing moose burgers and putting maple syrup on our poutine. And we also like to examine Canadian-centric myths about the Canadian flag. So you may have heard, perhaps in the scuttlebutt around the barbecue, that there are some special symbolism attached to the Canadian flag. Specifically, the points on the maple leaf. Do they refer to Canada's provinces and territories?
Wouldn't there be 12 points then?
Well, see, Don, you just sort of hit the nail on the head right there, because there is, in fact, 11 points on the maple leaf. So, obviously, the answer is no, because we have 10 provinces and 2 territories.
Ah, but you know how you can square that circle, just to keep the conspiracy alive?
Mm-hmm.
We have 10 provinces and one peak to represent Canada as a whole. Or yeah. Perhaps it's England, the mother country.
Or yes, we could do that as well. So the general myth here about the Canadian flag, I guess, is sort of one of those things that you hear on the schoolyard playground. It's just kind of stuck around. So I'll give you a bit of a refresher course on the history of our flag. Now, prior to the maple leaf, we had the red ensign, which was the traditional flag of colonial Canada. We had the Union Jack in one corner and a little sort of crest on a red flag. And this was our flag up till about the 1950s. We used it in World War I. It was considered a patriotic representation of Canada and our connection to the mother country.
And if I'm not correct, doesn't Australia and New Zealand have a flag very similar, but of course different iconography because they're not Canada, but the same basic format?
Basically, many of the former British colonies or Commonwealth countries do have the Union Jack somewhere on their flag. Now, we can thank Lester B. Pearson for removing the Union Jack, although not without controversy. Turns out people really liked that red ensign and weren't too happy about the removal. There was a big debate in this country over what the new flag would look like. So on May 27th in 1964, Pearson's minority government introduced a motion to Parliament for the adoption of his favorite design of a sea-to-sea, Canada's motto, flag with blue borders and 3 conjoined red maple leaves on a white field. And this is kind of a famous flag in some sense because of the way that Pearson sort of described it. There was one leaf represent the English heritage of Canada, one represent the French heritage, and one for other. Which was not the best way of saying it. It came to be known as Pearson's pennant, and Diefenbaker, the leader of the opposition at the time, demanded that there be a referendum on the flag issue. Pearson formed a 15-member multi-party parliamentary committee to select a new design. And they had a lot of designs, and they were able to narrow them down to three flags. So the first one was Pearson's pennant with the three maple leaves. The second one was a one maple leaf flag with red bars on the side, but not the design that we're familiar with. This maple leaf had 13 points on it. And the third flag was a 13-pointed maple leaf that featured a Union Jack and a fleur-de-lis on either side of it. So the debate was so heated that it required a cooling-off period of a couple months. And during this time, John Reed, who was the Federal Commissioner of Exhibitions and designer of the flag, Jacques Saint-Cree, were discussing it, and they felt it wasn't quite right. So they set it up at Reed's headquarters in this very large hall, and they stared at it from the other side of the hall, trying to figure out why it just didn't look right. And what they discovered was that it was too, quote, busy at the bottom. And so Reed asked Saint-Cree to take off two of the 4 points, and in doing so, he created the flag we all know today. The design was approved unanimously by the committee on the 29th of October in 1964. It was later passed by a majority vote in the House of Commons on the 15th of December 1964, and then the Senate added its approval 2 days later. And finally, Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Canada, proclaimed the new flag on January 28th, 1965, and was inaugurated on February 15th of the same year at an official ceremony held on Parliament Hill in Ottawa.
Ooh, although, you've just uncovered a new conspiracy.
Oh.
You've proven that the first time traveler, or a time traveler, is a Canadian. Because you noted that the first one was 13 points.
Yes.
13 points does equate to the current condition of 10 provinces and 3 territories.
Well, if they had gone with the 13-pointed star, or 13-pointed maple leaf, yeah, I could see there being some legs to this. But, of course, none of it was not there at the time. And I guess you could also say, well, what's going to happen if Labrador and Newfoundland have a divorce?
Yes. Or what happens if Labrador and Newfoundland... Trinidad and Tobago. I heard rumors again that someone is saying, hey, why don't we let them join Canada as a territory or province so that we'd have a southern holiday location?
That's precisely the reason, too.
It almost sounds like, you know, the British conquered Gibraltar just so that they'd have some place to laze away during the summer, you know?
Surely the British aren't that foresighted.
Maybe, I don't know. Well, you heard the Queen got a raise, apparently, recently, so she's making a bit more money. But what do you think about the flag? I mean, it's very iconic, classic in some ways, but the maple leaf strikes me as kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say weird, but of all the things that is of Canada, I mean, obviously the maple leaf is now, but I mean, you had the beaver, there's the horse, the Rocky Mountains.
It's funny. I mean, I remember when I was doing research on this, I found some interesting discussions about using the beaver as an image, and there were some pretty not safe for work remarks made about why we shouldn't use this hideous rodent on our flag. One of my personal views on it is that a flag needs to be simple enough that a child can draw it. And I think I've seen many flags that are really cool that have like dragons and crests and stuff on them, but they're too complicated. They're too busy. I think we're served by having a nice, simple design. And the maple leaf, what I like about it is that it's not necessarily, you can't really claim it by any group of people in Canada. Like, it doesn't necessarily favor Anglo-Canadians or French-Canadians or anyone, really. It's just kind of a symbol. And it's, you know, it's not like a gun or something that's violent, like swords. It's got a nice sort of Canadian feel to it. I guess that's because I grew up with it.
Yeah, and that's the hard part is, I mean, you can't really separate yourself because for us, it's traditional. It's like the people who were sort of against the adoption of this particular flag versus the old red with the Union Jack on it. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why they wanted it is because, well, that's what a flag should look like because it's always been our flag and we know what it's like in that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and to a certain extent, The red ensign has sort of survived. I mean, it's still flown on certain occasions, and many of the provincial flags. I think Ontario's flag very closely resembles the red ensign.
Manitoba's as well. But actually, it's funny. I was going across articles, and this is more like a Cracked or Pop BuzzFeed type thing, of the most artistic flags of the world. And BC's flag, Meg the Cut, I think we're something like 10th or something.
Yeah.
Because we're very, well, it's kind of busy. busy, but it's very majestic. And
it's very pleasing to the eye.
So people would say.
Yes.
So, Ethan.
Yes.
How are your drugs?
My drugs are okay. Thank you for asking.
Good, good, good. I came across an article recently in the Nature Review of Neuroscience. Yes, I'm that kind of nerd. Mm. Entitled, The Effects of Schedule I Drugs. It's a very long title. The Effects of Schedule I Drugs, Loss in Neurological Research and Treatment Innovation. In it, a neuroscientist, David Nutt, is attempt essentially to rally the neurological community to push for reform in the controlled drugs.
David Nutt, that name rings a bell. I believe he's come up on topics of drugs before on this show. Isn't he something of a maverick reformer?
He's a bit. He's very much sort of the. We'll go into it a little bit later on that. But yeah, he's pushing the boundaries on this because he pushes for what he calls, and I think we would agree, evidence-based regulation as opposed to moral or political-based regulation. And he kind of brings up, you know, how our current laws are essentially, what was his quote on this? Is that this is the greatest form of scientific censorship since the Catholic Church banned Copernicus and Galileo.
Nice. Sort of thing.
So he's not very subtle about his criticisms of the current state of conditions. So let's start off. So what do we mean by controlled drugs? The standards are actually outlined in three UN treaties, act, conventions. There's the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, the 1971 Convention on Psychotropic Substance, and the 1988 Convention Against Illicit Trafficking in Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances. In Canada, we specifically have the Controlled Drug and Substances Act. Now, this paper is Nutter himself is British and based. So it's largely focused on the UK and the US. So things may be slightly different depending on where you are on the globe. That said, there are two British laws that are important in this particular discussion that also show some of the arbitrariness of the regulation. They are the US Misuse of Drugs Act, which regulates what you're not supposed to do with drugs, and the UK Misuse of Drugs Regulations, which sets out what you can do with drugs. Basically, all these laws sort of divide drugs into several schedules or tiers. The lower the number, the more restrictive the regulation / prohibition is on them. Schedule 1 is the most restrictive, and to be classified as a Schedule 1 drugs, you must satisfy basically three criteria. First, the drug or other substances has a high potential for abuse. Second, the drug or other substance has no current accepted medical use in the United States. This is based on the United States version of it, but it's pretty much the same everywhere. And third, there is a lack of accepted safety for use of the drugs or other substances under medical supervision. Now, it was kind of criticized, it started off by saying, I mean, one, you know, when you say potential for abuse, well, what do you really mean by abuse? It's kind of a fuzzy term. Right. I mean, some people abuse chocolate. You know, does that make it a class one type drug? Now, of course, Schedule 2 is similar to Schedule 1, but it's like, you know, there are accepted medical uses for it and so on. So what are some of the Schedule 1 drugs? Well, pot or cannabis, cocaine, LSD, MDA or MDMA, or aka ecstasy, and magic mushrooms, psychoactive ingredient, psilocybin. In the U.S., cocaine is a Schedule 2, and heroin is a Schedule 2 in the U.N., but Schedule 1 in the United States. So there's kind of a reversal there. And again, a slight inconsistency, which is kind of the heart of the article. Now, the author points out that the relative harm done by these drugs is not really comparable, at least according to the research or what little there has been on it. And again, there's more on that later. So when you're comparing something like marijuana to cocaine, you're not talking apples to apples. You're talking very much oranges to oranges. And he points out that a lot of the reasons why some of these drugs became a Schedule 1 versus a Schedule 2 or whatever is partly on their historical precedent. So the new drugs, so LSD, MDMA, that sort of thing, those are like new chemical drugs, and there's no real history to them. So they're presumed to be dangerous sort of from the outset. But heroin, which like I say, is actually a Schedule 2 internationally, or cocaine, which can be, again, and that's because at one point these were seen as sort of medical units. The odd ones, of course, are marijuana and magic mushrooms. Well, maybe not magic mushrooms. That's kind of a West Coasty thing. But, I mean, pot's been used for centuries as a form. But there is that big thing about apparently 100 or so years ago, a big move to get rid of hemp by the cotton manufacturers or something like that. So, again, politically driven, not science-based. Now, like I say, it points out that cannabis and other sex drugs are also actually used for medical treatment. So even by their own sort of classification, they don't quite fit. The point points out that many of the drugs weren't placed there for evidence reasons, but for political reasons. It's notable that LSD was actually widely experimented with, and no, not in the recreational sense, although that did go on, but in like real honest science, prior to its banning in 1960, which seemingly the banning is based on some kind of logic that, well, the kids are doing LSD and kids don't want to go to Vietnam to fight the commies. Therefore, LSD must be causing it. So they banned it, like I say, pretty much strictly on political basis. In fact, there's a very good quote of Robert F. Kennedy sitting there saying, well, why was this legal last week, but it's now illegal this week? You know, what reasons do we have? And there were none that could be presented, mm-hmm. or none credible. Because again, right. There's always apocryphal, what's the word? Anecdotal. That's the word I'm looking
right.
for. Evidence.
Right, right.
So there's also the whole idea now that the fact that these, the main point of the article is not to sort of legalize all drugs, although, again, we talked about Nutter before, and I think you're right. I think that not before that he sorry. I think he is actually for a severe legalization of drugs in general. But what he's focusing on here is that one of the justifications to say, well, let's make all the drugs legal, or let's make all these certain drugs legal, is because we know what their harm value and their therapeutic value is. And the only way to do that is to do research into it. And by having these laws as classified as Schedule 1, it basically really puts a big roadblock in front of that. So he points out some of the difficulties that come up. So first, to do research into these drugs, you must the hospital research facility must get a very special license to do so. For something like, let's say, MDMA, so that's, again, your ecstasy, which has been used for psychological therapy, therapies in the post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's weird that, ironically enough, you need this special license for ecstasy, but you don't, and again, this is based in the UK, you don't need it to have heroin. And you think, well, of the two, isn't one more? So to get these licenses is a very long and costly affair. These licenses often take at least a year or more to get and cost thousands of dollars. In fact, the author pointed out that a Canadian example where it took 4 years to get approval to study ecstasy. Now, of course, this has an effect on many researchers who just don't want to put in the effort. I mean, why go to all this effort for this one sort of thing when I could be spending that time in the lab? Of course, once the license is obtained, these drugs must be held in very special facilities to ensure that they are not, quote, diverted, i.e. stolen and used for recreational use. He mentions that according to the conditions imposed, one group anyhow, twice daily had to have two authorized people go in and measure the stash to make sure it hadn't gone missing. These special facilities, of course, add thousands of dollars to the cost. The regulations are not only applied to the research research study in grams of stuff, so something that you might actually want to steal, but even subgram stuff where you're doing like in vitro cell cultures and that sort of thing, which again just sort of gets people away from wanting to do this particular work. Then, of course, comes the issue of procuring the drugs themselves. Sadly, to do good research, I think sadly, you can't just run down to the corner and buy a bag from Jimmy, your local dealer. Quality is everything. But because the production of these drugs are illegal, you have to go, again, to a manufacturer who gets this very special license and has to go through all these bells and whistles in order to produce the stuff to get what you need to do your research. This means that a gram of psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, costs $12,000 compared to like $30 if you went down to Jimmy and bought it off of him. And to do good research, you often need many, many doses. So one research projected that they needed 100 doses that was going to cost them over $250,000. This, of course, leads to the next problem, money. There's not a lot to go around. And because of the social stigma attached to this type of research, funding groups want to shy away from it as well. So you not only have very expensive research to do, but the people who might give you money to do this are victims of the social stigmatization that you get anyhow. So effectively what the author is pointing out and what he's trying to rally the community to go against is that although technically there's no prohibition to do research on these drugs, in practice there is a ban. And this, of course, as he points out in great detail, that there is a lot of a lot in this context, because again, you're dealing with one or two studies as opposed to dozens, and you need to do the dozens that show that these things do have efficacious and they can be helpful. And to add on to that, because a lot of these rules are sort of based in the UN, it's almost impossible to change them. There is no real mechanism to take a drug from Schedule 1 and move it to Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 or Schedule 4. And that's another discussion that needs to be had. So what are your opinions on drugs?
Well, one of the things that relates to this particular line of research is that not only are they crippling the research into specifically these drugs, so LSD or whatever, but they're potentially crippling the benefits that we could learn by understanding how these drugs work. You know, perhaps we can't have a cure for a condition or a treatment by using one of these drugs, but by understanding how one of these drugs works, that could lead us to a treatment that is perfectly legal. And, you know, science doesn't follow laws, right? Like, it doesn't, you know, there's no natural evil gene.
Are you saying there are no laws in science?
Well, there's no naturally evil gene in LSD, right? There's not like the drug is trolling an evil mustache. It's just a grouping of chemicals. And if we can understand how those chemicals react with our biology, we may be able to learn something about how we can treat conditions that we experience.
And that's where it gets even worse than that, because one of the things that I haven't mentioned here that you remind me of is that, again, this is very politically or morally based, because one of the things in the United States, the drug agency responsible for this area actually has a very explicit that if you do research into cannabis, it cannot be for therapeutic use. Which seems really, really weird that in a lot of ways, and again, some of the research that is done that says, you know, drugs are dangerous for you. Part of the reason why there seems to be more of that around than perhaps warrants it from an anecdotal experience is because there's a push by government agencies, by social conservative groups to put up the money to show you this is an evil. And that's much easier to get funding for than one saying, well, can we use LSD to help treat anxiety disorder, depression. So mm-hmm. there's a political cultural bias to try and find the negative of these drugs because they are cast as innately evil, which prevents the way science, which should be done, which is from a neutral standpoint. They're not good. They're not bad. They just are tools for us to see into the world around us.
Yes. Well, speaking of social cultural perceptions of evil, let's take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back to finish that metaphor.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to citr.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So, as I mentioned, speaking of cultural perceptions of evilness, we have some atheist news. The organization American Atheists has unveiled a new monument outside a Florida courthouse a few days ago.
Is it an upside down cross? No, that would be Satanism. Is it Jesus?
It is a 1,500-pound granite bench with various quotations from Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and Madeline O'Hare. It's basically a bench, which is about 4 feet in length, with a slab next to it about 4 feet high. So the story behind the monument goes back to last May when a local group, the Community Men's Fellowship, a Christian group, gave the city of Bradford County, Florida, the gift of a $22,000 Ten Commandments monument to put outside the county courthouse. American Atheist and plaintiff Daniel Cooney filed a lawsuit against the county. Officials were ready to take down the monument, but the Community Men's Fellowship refused to remove it, claiming that they prayed on it and refused to comply. So after consultation with the city, American Atheists agreed to put up their own monument, and they fundraised $6,000, and the monument went up a few days ago.
You know, I haven't looked at the Christian monument, but it struck me as so practical that the atheist one would be a bench. I mean, It's not only a monument, so you can go... Hey,
that was on
this,
purpose.
But it's practical.
That's actually on purpose. They mentioned how they wanted to actually have a purpose so that people could go there and sit and, you know, look at the scenery and stuff like that. So that good for pointing that out. So some quotations on the monument include this one from Madeline O'Hare, who was the founder of American Atheists. Quote, "An atheist believes that a hospital should be built instead of a church. An atheist believes that a deed must be done instead of a prayer set. An atheist strives for involvement in life and not escape into death. He wants disease conquered, poverty banished, war eliminated." There's also a quote from the Treaty of Tripoli. "The government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion." And a quote from good old Thomas Jefferson, "Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of homage to reason than of blindfolded fear." Let's see, there's one from John Adams, founding father. "It will never be pretended that any persons employed in the service," quote, writing the Constitution, "had interviews with the gods or were in any degree under the inspiration of heaven." And I think my favorite, Benjamin Franklin, "When religion is good, I conceive it will support itself. And when it does not support itself and God does not take care to support it so that its professors are obliged to call for help of the civil power, 'tis a sign, I apprehend, of its being a bad one."
Wow. Kind of convoluted, but...
He was wordy. It also lists some of the punishments for breaking the Ten Commandments. So it's got some quotes from the Old Testament. I won't read them here. After the unveiling of the monument, American Atheist President Dave Silverman announced this was, in fact, the first of 50 similar monuments that were going to go up throughout the nation wherever they are needed. So, exciting news. Yeah. The event drew at about 200 people, most of whom were supporters. However, there were a number of Christian groups that came out to protest. One group blared Christian music. One group, the Florida League of the South, which had signs that said, "Yankees go home." I guess they thought they were at their baseball game or something. Michael Tubbs, who is the state chairman of the Florida League of the South, said, quote, "We reject outsiders coming to Florida, especially from outside what we refer to as the Bible Belt, and trying to remake us in their own image. We do feel like it's a stick in the eye to the Christian people of Florida to have these outsiders come down here with their money and their leadership and promote their outside values here." So really welcoming endorsement for living in Florida.
Well, was Cooney from New York or was he a local resident?
I would assume he was a local resident since he was one of the plaintiffs. I'm sure that American Atheists, they have a chapter in Florida, and I don't think Dave Silverman is from Florida. But I think the notion here that they're bringing sort of their big city values to this small town courthouse is a little telling. I mean, that's sort of the... inherit the wind style rhetoric there. At one point, someone who was driving by in a car tossed a toilet seat and a roll of paper at the crowd. No one was hit by either of those things, but I mean, I think it's a good thing. A toilet seat probably could have cracked someone's skull open. And at one point, Eric Hovind, a creationist from Pensacola, jumped atop the peak of the monument and shouted his thanks to atheists for giving him a platform to declare Jesus is real. So, I mean, not exactly respectful behavior on the part of the Christians coming to protest. Which I think is pretty telling, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're the ones who create these, what they would call free speech spaces. And when someone brings free speech they don't approve of, they heckle and jump on monuments.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yes.
It seems there. Because you're right. I mean, it's they're the first one to sit there and say, listen, you know, you can't oppress my rights and my freedoms to do X, Y, and Z. But there always seems to be the first ones up to try and oppress everyone else's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an assault on Christian privilege, right? So I instead of maybe sitting back and thinking, okay, well, we got our monument up, they got their monument up, surely that is fair. But no, it's they feel like they have the extra right to present their point of view and receive absolutely no counter opinion from anyone else.
And I never quite understand the hostility that you get, because I'm guessing here, and I could be wrong, that, you know, if this Christian fellowship group put up a monument for the Baptists, and then someone came down and put up a Roman Catholic monument, you wouldn't get the same kind of hostility, you know, whereas, and oddly enough, because, I mean, really, they're kind of in more competition than atheists are, because they both believe in the woo, it's just which particular team are you playing for, Protestant, Catholic, whatever, but they seem to almost exclusively reserve this sort of hostility for atheists and agnostics. I mean, if you go back 100 or 200 years, yeah, they were wailing on each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like they've decided to sort of call a sort of truce on themselves to focus on these, and then, quote, external groups. I mean, Muslims get it as well, I'm quite sure.
Yeah, but I imagine that if it had been Muslims setting up a monument, I'm sure there would have been protests as well. It's difficult to say whether or not the vitriol of and the anger would be the same, or perhaps be of a different nature. I mean, the quote from that fellow from the Florida Society for the South or whatever doesn't give me any hope that it would be any different if a group of Muslims or a group of Jews or Hindus decided to put up a monument. He sounds just as radical and offensive no matter who you are.
I wonder if it had been a couple of the local native group that had put up a monument. To which, of course, you could say, well, no, wait a minute. Who came in and put up what? We were here first. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's take another quick break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back after this.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptchick and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
And we're back. Food science, the ugly, the good, and the sarcastic. Every so often, you get a cluster of stories. Well, really more of a tree in this particular case, a metaphor that will become clear later on, that show why we must be careful in what we read. So the first story is the ugly of food reporting. In an article posted on BuzzFeed entitled 8 foods we eat in the U.S. that are banned in other countries. With the subtitle, this brings a whole new meaning to the phrase food poisoning. Of course, it's obvious from the title, it's intended to expose, quote, the dirty secret about how Americans are being poisoned by their food, with the proof that these foods are illegal in other parts of the civilized world. So let's check out the list. I should warn listeners that the first time around, I'm going to try and turn off my bullshit filters so you can get a grasp of what's sort of being said. So I'm going to sort of play the straight man when I read these through the first time. First one, artificial food dyes. Makes your food pretty and can inhibit nerve cell development. Brominated vegetable oil. Makes food dye stick to liquids but also causes birth defects and major organ damage. Potassium bromate or bromate flour. Great for impatient bakers. Bad for your kidneys and nervous system. Azote carbonamide. Try and say that 3 times fast. Bleaches flour, plastics, and induces asthma. BHA and BHT, waxy preservatives linked to cancer and tumors. So that's betalaetahydrooxyacetal and betalaetahydrooxytolune, for those acronym channeled. Not that you can figure out what I said from what I just said, but arsenic. Basically, the dish will kill you. That will kill you. Olestra. Lowers calorie count while causing vitamin depletion and anal leakage. Synthetic growth hormone, RBGH and RBST, harmful to cows and linked to tumors development in humans. So RBH is recombinant bovine growth hormone and RBST is recombinant bovine steatotrope, of course, which we all know what that is, obviously.
Right.
So each one of these particular headlines are sort of broken down to sort of what foods contain it, why it's dangerous, and who has banned it. So again, let's go back to the list. Artificial food dyes found in practically everything we eat. Macaroni and cheese! And that's their emphasis, not mine. Artificial dyes, they say, are made from chemicals derived from petroleum, which is also used to make gasoline, diesel fuel, asphalt, and tars. Artificial dyes that are linked to brain cancer, nerve cell deterioration, hyperactivity in children, just to name a few. Apparently, it's banned in Norway, Finland, Australia, France, and the UK. Now, I find it a little hard to believe that all artificial dyes are banned in these countries, but sourcing was a bit of an issue with this particular article. Brominated vegetable oils, found in sport drinks and citric-flavored sodas. Bromide is a chemical used to stop carpets from catching fire. So you can see why drinking it may not be the best idea. BVO is linked to major organ system damage, birth defects, growth problems, schizophrenia, and hearing loss. Banned in over 100 countries. Potassium bromate, found in wraps, rolls, breadcrumbs, bagels, flatbreads. Derived from the same harmful chemical as brominated vegetable oil. Only problem is it's linked to kidney damage, cancer, and nervous system damage. Banned in Europe, Canada, and China. If it's the same chemical, how come it doesn't cause schizophrenia and hearing loss?
Yeah.
Azote carbonate, found in breads, frozen dinner, boxed pasta, packaged baked goods. Used to bleach flour and foamed plastic, you know, like yoga mats and sneakers and that sort of thing. Azotocarbonamide is known to induce asthma, banned in Australia and most of Europe. BHA, BHT, found in cereals, mixed nuts, gums, butter, meats, dehydrated potatoes. Used to keep foods from becoming rancid. BHA and BHT are known to cause cancer in rats. And we are next. I like that little bit at the end, just in case you weren't nervous. They wanted to make sure you are. It's banned in the UK, Japan, and many other countries. Arsenic, found in poultry. Used in some chicken feed to make the meat appear pinker and fresher. Arsenic is a poison that will kill you if you ingest enough. Banned in the EU. Olestra. It's found in fat-free potato chips, corn chips, and french fries. Created as a substitute for cooking oil. Olestra robs your body of its ability to absorb vitamins. Fun side effects include cramping and leaky bowels. Most famous in the 80s when Frito-Lay's released the ill-fated Wow brand of chips. Most people thought Wow was in the flavor, but no, Wow was in the other end of the particular operation. Banned in the EU and Canada. Synthetic growth hormone, RB, RBHG and RBST. Found in milk and dairy products, growth hormones are bad for cows and peoples, potentially causing infertility, weakened muscles, and the whole array of cancers, banned in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Japan, and the EU. So, you might think, well, what are your references? Well, none are given, actually. Well, I lie. There is one that was given that refers to a book called Rich Food, Poor Food. Although it appears that in an earlier version, there were actual links, probably lifted from the book itself. But it seems those became kind of inconvenient because if you actually go to the links, well, we'll get into that when we do a bit of the debunking. Of course, when I found out about the book, my sort of BS detector started tingling because if it was a new release, they often do these sort of things to sort of push the sales. But it's actually a bit dated of a book, so I think the author genuinely believes this is part of it, maybe just to push visitors to the site. So, should we stop eating? Should we start up our own organic farm? Ethan, what do you think about the way this was presented? We'll go into the debunking later, but how?
Right. Well, I do recall reading this article when it first came out. And, maybe I'm being too skeptical. But when I go to BuzzFeed, I want to get gossipy news about celebrities and cute pictures of puppies chasing things. So when I find articles about health and science, I try to be extra skeptical.
Not even the ones about the 10 most delicious foods in the world?
Well, we already know. I already figured those out, so yeah.
Okay, well, so, but as a good skeptic, and you're actually kind of a pre-skeptic because you discounted it to begin with, which may not be the best thing in the world.
No, I admit I could be hyper-skeptical on this.
But we will endeavor to see if, if this is science is real or not. And this leads me to the next piece, the sort of good of food reporting. It's from the Coronate blog In the Pipeline and entitled, 8 Toxic Foods, A Little Chemical Education. This post was written not because the person who wrote it was a big shell for Big Chem or he's the CEO of Dow Chemical. No, he wrote it because, and I quote, it was the roaring success of the BuzzFeed piece coupled with its chirpy, confident, and bizarrely wrong take on chemistry and toxicology that set me off. So, what is his rebuttal? Again, let's go back through our list. Artificial food dyes. So it's true, you can get a lot of things from petroleum, like dyes, but you also get creamers. I mean, if you ever read on the label, you'll see made from edible oil products. You get feedstock and lots of other stuff. So why single out the dyes when you're doing this and not the artificial creamers? And let's remember, petroleum is just a carbon compound, and everything is made of carbon compounds that we, not everything we eat, but lots of things. So if you manipulate them, it doesn't have to be bad. But does it cause brain cancer, nerve cell deterioration, and hyperactivity? Studies about hyperactivity have actually shown little or no correlation. So again, very weak, mainly anecdotal. There is none that I could find studies that link dyes to nerve cell deteriorations. But in a odd sort of way, I mean, it's a very broad category. What do you mean by nerve cell deterioration? I mean, aging causes nerve cell deterioration.
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's just they've been making it up. The only brain tumor study that seems to be connected to dyes was one done in the 80s when they did what was kind of popular back in that day. Do something to really extreme success and then excess and then claim that the big excess is the same amount for the minor. The big one that I can think of was some of the artificial sugars like aspartame and all that, where they would give rats the equivalent of 10 years worth of aspartame every day, and after a year the rats became sick and they said, see, aspartame, you shouldn't have it in your coffee because it'll kill you. So the rats, and they used rats, and you kind of got to feel sorry for the rats because they're hard to love, but they get a lot of shit thrown at them.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, they fed the rats up to 2% of their daily diet in food dyes. And that's many, many, many orders of magnitude anyone would get be exposed to in their daily, in a lifetime, to get these sort of negative results. I couldn't find any follow-up studies on this, and I suspect that there aren't any. And if you're eating dye in that big of a bulk, cancer is probably the least of your worries.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bromated vegetable oil. First, we have a bit of a bait and switch here. Bromine, which is the scary chemical, like chlorine, is a horribly toxic chemical. They used it in World War One. That said, it's not bromine, but bromide. And that one electron here and there can make a huge difference. In the same way, if you think chlorine is a nerve gas they used in World War II, chloride is table salt. That said, like too much salt, you can get too much bromide. The article originally referenced WebMed, where there were a total of two cases related to bromide vegetable oil poisoning. These people managed to drink about 6 liters of pop a day. Again, you know, if you try hard, anything can be bad for your health. I suspect bromide poisoning was probably the least of these people's issues if they're drinking that much pop in one day. Even me in my heyday wouldn't get up to that much. I used to drink a lot of pop at one
day. I had a science professor in high school who would drink about that many cans of pop a day. It was really disgusting.
Liters?
Cans of pops.
Yeah, that's like third.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
so now we go to potassium bromate. Again, bad chemistry. Bromine is not bromide, nor is it bromate. That said, well, bromate is not good for you, and it actually, if it's found in tap water, they actually sometimes will make people stop drinking it. But again, we're also talking about potassium bromate, not bromate on its own. Mm-hmm. And chemicals combined together can be very, very different. So again, hydrogen on its own goes boom. Hydrogen with oxygen makes life possible. So, is potassium bromate toxic? And again, I'm not trying to contradict myself. The first part was just to make sure that you can't assume one based on the other. But in this particular case, yes. Potassium bromate can be toxic. But there's a big but here, and it's an important one. In one study that showed that if you feed a lot of potassium bromate to mice, 6.1 grams per kilo, there were links to kidney damage and cancer and nervous system. Note, though, that in lower doses, there is no effect. And actually, another study that was done on the same one and actually used 10 times higher doses didn't show any results again. So again, kind of hit and miss. So maybe it's not toxic after all. But let's assume the first one got it right. The precautionary principle. We'll go with that. The amount you get in baking is about 20 parts per million. And actually, really, in fact, almost all that is destroyed in the baking process itself. But how much would you have to actually eat to get sort of the mice level of toxicity? Well, an average person weighs about 75 kilos. That means you would need to ingest about 457 milligrams of potassium bromate to get the equivalent dosage as the mice did. That equates roughly to 33 pounds of bread. Again, at that point, potassium bromate is probably the least of your problems. And that's every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Azidote carbon amide. Here, we are not playing so much with chemistry, but dosage. So in bread making, you can get up to 45 parts per million in the bread, or it's used in the bread. But again, when you heat this stuff up, it actually turns into something that's quite harmless called burine. But let's assume, again, all of it makes it through to your table. Well, azidone carbonamide actually has to be labeled in the UK, may cause sensitization by inhalation. And of course, sensitization is linked with asthma, but the jury's still out whether this sensitization causes asthma. We don't know a lot about asthma. It's getting better, but so again, Ethan, you might say, ha, they got one right. It does. Well, no, or maybe. It depends on who you are. So as a consumer in the bread, no, because the doses you're getting are actually insignificant. But if you're one of these poor guys that's working in the factory where this stuff is used, that's why it has to be put on there. Because if you have a sufficient dosage of it, it will cause sensitivity, but not from your food in any significant way.
Right.
BHA and BHT. Well, if they do cause cancer, there's no statistical evidence in the real world. Although it is true these guys are found everywhere, cancer rates are really going down for most everything. Any study testing a correlation in humans between the exposure of these chemicals and cancer hasn't found any. In fact, these are actually regarded as antioxidant. Something like BHA can be found in health food stores for, quote, anti-aging properties. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think that's a good endorsement, but it does show that it's not poison necessarily. In animal studies, it actually seems to be kind of a clear wash. Some studies show an increased incidence in cancer, others show a decreased incidence in cancer. And in a way, the science kind of backs this up, because antioxidants are kind of like oxygen. A certain amount is good for you, but too much can actually cause more harm and problems. And this might sort of explain the bipolar experimental results. Arsenic, well, who can say anything about arsenic? It'll kill you. Well, it was actually a very popular poison in medieval times, that in Assassin's Tool Chest. They liked to use it a lot. So first, it's not actually fed to the birds. It's used as a medication. So it's put in their feed, but it's put in their feed because that's the most convenient way to get them. And it's used to reduce intestinal pesticides. So,
parasites.
Thank you. Not pesticides. Good. So when it's added to their feed, it's actually in quite a small dosage.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you can find up to 2.3 parts per billion, and that's B with a billion with a B. In your chicken, right? So some of that arsenic can come through and has been measured. But when you put this in the context of other things like rice, where you can get anywhere from 100 to 170 parts per billion, it doesn't seem to be that much of an issue. And note that I said was and not is. As it turns out, the major source for this sort of medication is Roxarsen. Roxarsen, yes, sounds like a bad song. And it was actually voluntarily withdrawn from the market. There are still some other sources used out there, but really manufacturers have just gone away to a less harmful sort of supplement instead of using this particular one, which, of course, goes to our next particular one. Actually, I imagine whatever they're going to replace the arsenic with will be on the list for the next BuzzFeed article on this particular show.
Probably.
Synthetic growth hormone. First, they call it beef hormones for a reason. They work on cows. They don't work on people. It's not like you're having human growth hormone in there. The science has focused pretty much on the effect of other hormones in milk, actually called IGF-1, which BGH can increase the level of sometimes. Actually, from the research that I found, the levels that it does form of this IGF-1 is still within normal variations level. It's just when you have the growth hormone, you tend to be in the upper end of that more consistently than the lower end. Some studies have shown a link between high levels of IGF-1 in the blood and others not. One area of research actually is kind of directed at blocking the IGF-1 as an effective way to sort of treat tumors. But so far, it's a dead-end path. It doesn't seem to work, which, again, weakens the sort of causal link between IGF-1 and cancer. Studies show, though, that milk drinkers do tend to have a higher level of the IGF-1 in their blood, but so do soy milk drinkers. And I can't quite see how bovine growth hormone gets into soy milk. So that seems a little misleading. The research is based on IGF-1 in the bloodstream, and there's no clear evidence that ingesting IGF-1 via milk is or can be absorbed into the bloodstream. In studies that showed that the absorption does occur, so there's one or two studies that maybe, an infant would have to drink, 1.5 liters of milk every day to get 1% increase in their IGF levels, which again is a lot of milk for a little baby to drink.
That's true.
So the last one is Olestra. Of the things on the list, I'm going to give them Olestra. If you like to eat food that causes anal leakage, well, again, I think you have bigger problems than Olestra. So before we go on, thoughts, Ethan?
Well, I remember when the article sort of debunking the BuzzFeed sort of article made the rounds. And frankly, you know, again, I couldn't help but say, well, again, if you're going to for BuzzFeed to science, you're maybe in the wrong neck of the woods. Maybe try Boing Boing or IO9 or something else.
But one of the things I found so interesting about it and doing this debunking is, although this was on BuzzFeed, but we've both heard these exact same things on quote-unquote more serious things like Huffington Post or something like that.
Right? Oh, yeah. I mean, this kind of – I guess it's a combination of things like anomaly hunting and misunderstanding of basic chemistry – combines to form serious misunderstandings of how the food we eat interacts with us. I mean, how many times have we talked about the issue of, it's not so much whether or not you're eating something that's bad for you, it's how much you're eating of that thing. It's the dose that matters. And I think that the original author here is either ignorant of that or just intentionally glossing over it to make a sensationalist piece.
Well, not to be outdone, The Guardian published an article, which is our sarcastic angle, the six chemicals we consume in our food and drink that should be banned. And it starts off with E290 and says, E numbers are bad, and we all know that. E29 is no exception. It sneaks its way into fizzy drinks, bread, and even homemade cakes. But this chemical is probably the worst of the lot. Because if you don't stop producing it, then we're heading for a global disaster. The scientific literature is quite clear on the subject. There are over 1 million peer-reviewed papers that describe the harmful effects this is having on our environment. And they put this in our kids' lemonade. So I should point out to begin with that the e-number thing, it's actually a reference to food-info.net database. And really, everything has an e-number. It's just one way that you can kind of consistently talk about something and say, oh, I'm referring to that when you say something. And for the record, E290 is carbon dioxide. Again, if you have too much of it, it will kill you. It definitely is killing the planet, or changing it. So the next one, and take note, using scary words or weird words to describe something is one of the things that's often quite done to fake the sort of evilness of it. And our next one goes on with this. 8-methyl-N-vanillin-1-6-monomade. With a name like I just said, it's bound to be a baddie. If you want more evidence of its unpleasantness, then you only need to know that the police use it for riot control. Doesn't stop it turning up in the nation's favorite foods. In fact, you have as much. You've probably all suffered from it when a zealous chef adds too much of it to your food. What is the good of this particular one? Well, it's bad for you. What do you think it is, Ethan?
I'm going to go with pepper.
Close. Capsaicin. Which is the... I think in pepper it's capsaicin too.
Yeah.
It's the thing that makes hot stuff hot.
Right.
Then they go on. They talk about denatured proteins. And they go, well, you might not know this, but Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and CJD, which is the human version of mad cow disease, are all caused by proteins that have misfolded or denatured. Basically, perfectly normal proteins get shape-shifted into evil versions of themselves, and they cause deadly diseases. And guess what? When you fry your eggs, you cause the same proteins in white to misfold. It leaves you with the obvious conclusion that Alzheimer's things is true. So don't eat your eggs because...
Or just ban proteins.
Yeah. Fried cooked proteins. Then you have CLNA. Not one, but two deadly poisons here. What do you think makes salty sack so appealing? Nothing but a delicious mix of chemical warfare agents that are used in the trenches of the First World War and an explosive metal. They put this onto crisps, nuts, and chips. So, you know, again, CLNA, which go, what that is? Well, if I say NaCl, sodium chloride. Salt. Yes. They also do the famous dihydrogen monoxide. Yeah, it's an old joke, so I kind of skipped it. The last one, actually, I thought was kind of interesting because this isn't really a joke, but it kind of is. Uranium.
Hmm.
Finally, one that glows in the dark. If anyone books... essentially, what they're going to talk about... Sorry, their quote is... I don't like how they stated, but essentially, you can get uranium-infused glassware. It was a big thing in the 20s and the 30s because it would glow in the dark and that sort of thing. But the levels of radiation are extremely low, so it's not really that dangerous. And you can actually buy it on the internet, which was kind of interesting. So that's the good, the bad, and the ugly or sarcastic of food science.
Good old Guardian, always... bringing the nasty to it, science reporting.
Yes.
Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so let's go to our skeptical highlights for the week. Don, do you have a highlight for us?
I have three websites that I wanted to mention. One of them was Carpe Diem, and there'll be a link on there. Essentially, you put in your age, and it will tell you when you die, which is always nice to know. It helps you plan out things. It's not a real important site, but it just struck me as kind of funny. Put in there, it's got this little graph that shows your life expectancy, and yeah, it's worth a laugh. The next one is Atlas Obscuria, and I discovered this recently. So basically, it's an atlas of all the weird and bizarre things in the world, like the deepest hole in the world and the most poisonous lake in the world and all that sort of thing. The graveyard for neon signs, and it's fun to just sort of go there. And explore. The other one, which is actually a plug-in for your browsers and such, is the Rebutter, and that's R-B-U-T-R. And basically what it does is when you put it onto your browser, it allows you to sort of link to a rebuttal of an article. So this BuzzFeed thing, we can link that particular article from Rebutter and post our rebuttal to whatever arguments they're making there. Hmm. And you actually get a lot of give and take about it. Now, one of the reasons why I think it's important for the skeptic community to go is this is a tool that could be used for good, but it could also be used for evil, where they take good science stories and you have the quacks in that rebuttal them and use them for bad. So it's good that we take over this before they do.
Yes, yes, well said. So my skeptical highlight is actually a follow-up from a previous skeptical highlight. Astronaut Chris Hadfield has retired, as I mentioned before. So we speculated, what will Chris get up to these days? Well, it turns out he's going to do some writing. That's right. Random House Canada has announced plans to publish Hatfield's An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth on October 29th. It's going to be the first of a two-book deal. And Chris will be talking about his training, his time in space, how he goes through his daily life now that he's, you know, getting back to Earth and getting used to our gravity. So it sounds like it'd be really interesting. I mean, Chris is a pretty engaging, funny guy, so it should be pretty cool. And I encourage you to keep your eyes open for that. Maybe he'll do a book tour. Who knows?
Ooh, I wonder if we get him on our show. That'd be cool.
That'd be awesome to get him on the show. We should do that right now.
Yes.
Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning flame.